5. The Fifth Declaration of War, 1987 to 1995. They make a desert and call it peace. Tacitus. The Palestinian Uprising, or Intifada, which broke out in December 1987, was a perfect example of the law of unintended consequences. Ariel Sharon and Menachem Begin had launched the invasion of Lebanon to quash the power of the PLO and thereby end Palestinian nationalist opposition in the occupied West Bank and Gaza to the absorption of those territories into Israel. This would complete the colonial task of historic Zionism, creating a Jewish state in all of Palestine. The 1982 war did succeed in weakening the PLO, but the paradoxical effect was to strengthen the Palestinian national movement in Palestine itself, shifting the focus of action from outside to inside the country. After two decades of a relatively manageable occupation, Begin and Sharon, two fervent partisans of the Greater Israel ideal, had inadvertently sparked a new level of resistance to the process of colonization. Opposition to Israel's land grab and military rule has erupted within Palestine repeatedly and in different forms ever since. The First Intifada, as it became known, erupted spontaneously all over the occupied territories, ignited when an Israeli army vehicle struck a truck in the Jabalia refugee camp in the Gaza Strip, killing four Palestinians. The uprising spread very quickly, although Gaza was the crucible and remained the most difficult area for Israel to bring under control. The Intifada generated extensive local organization in the villages, towns, cities, and refugee camps, and came to be led by a secret unified national leadership. The flexible and clandestine grassroots networks formed during the Intifada proved impossible for the military occupation authorities to suppress. After a month of escalating unrest, in January 1988, Defense Minister Yitzhak Rabin ordered the security forces to use force, might, and beatings. His iron fist policy was carried out through the explicit practice of breaking the demonstrators' arms and legs and cracking their skulls, as well as beating others who aroused the soldiers' ire. Within a short time, widely televised images of heavily armed soldiers brutalizing teenage Palestinian protesters created a major media backlash in the United States and elsewhere, showing Israel in its true light as a callous occupying power. Only 5 years after the media coverage of the siege and bombing of Beirut, this exposure dealt another blow to the image of a country largely dependent on complacent American public opinion. In spite of the harmful impact of the 1982 war on Israel's standing, the country's shrewd public relations efforts had succeeded in re-anesthetizing much of U.S. public opinion. But unlike the televised air and artillery bombardments of Lebanon, which ended after 10 weeks, the violence of the Intifada ground on, year after brutal year, from December 1987 through 1993, winding down somewhat during the Gulf War and the peace conference organized by the United States in Madrid in October 1991. During this time, the uprising produced gripping scenes of street battles between young Palestinian protesters and Israeli troops, who were supported by armored personnel carriers and tanks. The iconic image from this period was of a small Palestinian boy hurling a stone at a huge Israeli tank. If it bleeds, it leads, the saying goes, and television viewers were riveted by repeated tableaus of wrenching violence, which inverted the image of Israel as a perpetual victim, casting it as Goliath against the Palestinian David. This was a constant drain on Israel, not only in terms of the pressure on its security forces, but also, and perhaps more significant, in terms of its reputation abroad, in some ways its most vital asset. Even Rabin, the man in charge, realized the importance of this political factor. A flattering New York Times interview with Rabin opened by claiming that Palestinian rioters have been winning the public relations battle against Israel in the world press. Defense Minister Yitzhak Rabin conceded today, stressing that the army is confronting something new and complex, a widespread uprising born of decades of Palestinian frustrations. At the time that the First Intifada broke out, the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza had been in place for 2 decades, taking advantage of a situation of relative calm Israel began the colonization of the occupied territories immediately after the 1967 war, eventually creating over 200 settlements, from cities of 50,000 residents to flimsy prefabricated clusters housing a few dozen settlers. For years, Israeli experts had assured their leaders and the public that the Palestinians living under what they called an enlightened occupation were content and fully under control. The eruption of massive grassroots resistance belied this notion. It was true that some Palestinians, intimidated by Israeli might and by a round of mass expulsions of more than 250,000 of their number after the 1967 war, had seemed to acquiesce at first to the new order imposed on them. It was also true that incomes in the West Bank and Gaza Strip rose significantly as tens of thousands of Palestinians were newly allowed to work in Israel. By 1976, however, alienation had intensified. Any expression of nationalism, flying the Palestinian flag, displaying the Palestinian colors, organizing trade unions, voicing support for the PLO or any other resistance organization, was severely suppressed with fines, beatings, and jail. Detentions and imprisonment usually featured torture of detainees. Protesting the occupation publicly or in print could lead to the same result, or even to deportation. More active resistance, especially that involving violence, invited collective punishment, house demolitions, imprisonment without trial under the rubric of administrative detention that could last for years, and even extrajudicial murder. That year, mayoral candidates backed by the PLO won municipal elections in Nablus, Ramallah, Hebron, and El Bira, as well as in other towns. A number of the mayors were deported in 1980, accused of incitement, and others were removed from office by the military occupation authorities in the spring of 1982, provoking widespread unrest. This was done in the lead-up to the invasion of Lebanon as part of Ariel Sharon's comprehensive campaign to uproot the PLO. One aspect of that campaign was an attempt to create local collaborationist groups, the Village Leagues, a project that never got off the ground because of widespread Palestinian refusal to cooperate with the occupation after the mayor's removal. Sharon's chosen instrument for this policy was a so-called Israeli Arabist, Menachem Milson, a professor of Arabic and a reserve colonel in the Israeli army. For a person to wear these two hats was not unusual. Most senior academic Middle East specialists in Israel doubled as reserve officers in military intelligence or other branches of the security services, engaged in spying on and oppressing the people they studied the rest of the time. Meanwhile, a new generation of Palestinians had come of age having known nothing but military occupation, and they were anything but acquiescent. These young people came out in public expressions of support for the PLO in East Jerusalem, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip, in spite of the risk of doing so. The years preceding the Intifada were marked by mass demonstrations by young Palestinians more fearless than their elders and by intensifying repression by Israeli security forces, whose superiors seemed heedless of the cumulative effect of the brutality they were ordering. Given all the signs of growing unrest, the uprising should have come as no surprise to the Israeli authorities. Yet their swift response was ill-conceived, heavy-handed, and disproportionate. The systematic brutality of the soldiers, most of them young draftees, toward the population they were charged with controlling was not only the result of frustration or even fear. Rabin's orders to break bones set the tone, but the excessive violence was also rooted in constant societal anti-Palestinian indoctrination, grounded in the dogmatic idea that Israel would be overwhelmed by the Arabs if its security forces did not deter them by force, since their supposedly irrational hostility to Jews was otherwise uncontrollable. The Intifada had been underway for nearly a year and a half when I took my first trip to Palestine since 1966, at which time the West Bank had been under Jordanian rule. During a visit to Nablus with some University of Chicago colleagues, after leaving my cousin Ziad's home one evening, we found ourselves in the winding streets of the old city, caught in a clash between young protesters and the Israeli troops who were chasing them, firing rubber bullets and tear gas. The soldiers did not catch any of the demonstrators, but they did eventually manage to disperse them. It was clear at that moment that there could be no lasting victory for Israel's forces in this kind of cat-and-mouse urban unrest. The young protesters could reappear at any moment somewhere else in the labyrinth of narrow alleys. Of course, the troops could simply kill them, and that happened all too frequently. From the beginning of the First Intifada to the end of 1996, 9 years, including 6 when the Intifada was ongoing, Israeli troops and armed settlers killed 1,422 Palestinians, almost one every other day. Of them, 294, or over 20%, were minors 16 and under. 175 Israelis, 86 of them security personnel, were killed by Palestinians during the same period. That 8-to-1 casualty ratio was typical, something one would not have known from much of the American media coverage. On another occasion, I was driving through Gaza City on the way to visit my cousin Huda, wife of Dr. Haidar Abdel Shafi, head of the Palestinian Red Crescent in Gaza. In the slow crawl of a traffic jam, our car passed a heavily armed Israeli patrol, the soldiers in the jeep holding their weapons at the ready. They were fidgety and nervous, and in their faces I saw a quality I had noticed in the Israeli troops in occupied Beirut in 1982. They were afraid. Their vehicles moved at a snail's pace through heavily populated built-up areas where the entire community loathed the occupation that the soldiers embodied and enforced. Soldiers of a regular army, no matter how heavily armed, will never feel secure in such circumstances. Rabin and others recognized the inherent problems that I saw on the streets of Nablus and Gaza. According to Itmar Rabinovich, Rabin's biographer, close collaborator, and tennis partner, the First Intifada brought the veteran general to the realization that a political solution was necessary. Nevertheless, he held fast to the deterrent effect of brutality. The use of force, Rabin said, including beatings, undoubtedly has brought about the impact we wanted, strengthening the population's fear of the Israel Defense Forces. Maybe so, but this brutality did not put an end to the uprising. The Intifada was a spontaneous, bottom-up campaign of resistance, born of an accumulation of frustration and initially with no connection to the formal political Palestinian leadership. As with the 1936-39 revolt, the Intifada's length and extensive support was proof of the broad popular backing that it enjoyed. The uprising was also flexible and innovative, developing a coordinated leadership while remaining locally driven and controlled. Among its activists were men and women, elite professionals and business people, farmers, villagers, the urban poor, students, small shopkeepers, and members of virtually every other sector of society. Women played a central role, taking more and more leadership positions as many of the men were jailed, and mobilizing people who were often left out of conventional male-dominated politics. Along with demonstrations, the Intifada involved tactics ranging from strikes, boycotts, and withholding taxes to other ingenious forms of civil disobedience. Protests sometimes turned violent, often ignited by soldiers inflicting heavy casualties with live ammunition and rubber bullets used against unarmed demonstrators or youths throwing stones. Nevertheless, the uprising was predominantly nonviolent and unarmed. A crucially important factor that helped mobilize sectors of society in addition to the young people protesting in the streets, while showing that the entirety of Palestinian society under occupation opposed the status quo and supported the Intifada. The First Intifada was an outstanding example of popular resistance against oppression and can be considered as being the first unmitigated victory for the Palestinians in the long colonial war that began in 1917. Unlike the 1936-39 revolt, the Intifada was driven by a broad strategic vision and a unified leadership. And it did not exacerbate internal Palestinian divisions. Its unifying effect and largely successful avoidance of firearms and explosives, in contrast to the Palestinian resistance movement of the 1960s and 1970s, helped to make its appeal widely heard internationally, leading to a profound and lasting positive impact on both Israeli and world public opinion. This was no accident. The Intifada was explicitly aimed not only at mobilizing Palestinians and Arabs, but also at shaping Israeli and world perceptions. That this was a key objective was clear from many of the tactics used, and also from the sophisticated and effective communication strategies of those who were able to explain to international audiences what the Intifada meant. These included articulate and worldly activists and intellectuals inside Palestine, such as Hanan Ashrawi, Haidar Abdel Shafi, Raja Shahada, Iyad al-Saraj, Ghassan al-Khatib, Zahira Kamal, Mustafa Barghouti, Rita Jakaman, Raji Surani, and many others. Those outside of Palestine, among them Edward Said and Ibrahim Abu Lughod, had a similar impact. By the early 1990s, the unified Palestinian stance had successfully made it clear that the occupation was untenable, at least as it had functioned in its first two decades. For all of the First Intifada's achievements, there was a hidden internal danger in its success and in the emergence of an effective local leadership with articulate, attractive spokespersons. A grassroots movement that supersedes established political elites constitutes a challenge to their power. After the PLO's defeat in Lebanon in 1982, the organization was stuck in a sterile and debilitating exile in Tunis and other Arab capitals. With its energy directed at an initially fruitless attempt to win U.S. acceptance as an interlocutor and Israeli acceptance as a partner to a settlement, the PLO was taken by surprise by the outbreak of a grassroots-led uprising and lost no time trying to co-opt and profit from it. Since most of those who had risen up in revolt in the occupied territories saw the PLO as their legitimate representative and its leaders as the embodiment of Palestinian nationalism, this posed few problems at the outset. The population of the occupied territories, who had watched from a distance the sacrifices of the PLO's militants in Jordan during Black September and in Lebanon throughout the civil war and the Israeli invasion, felt they were now shouldering part of the national burden. They were proud that Palestinians under occupation were taking the lead in the struggle for liberation. The problem with this development was the short-sightedness and limited strategic vision of the PLO's leaders in Tunis. Many of them did not fully understand the nature of the occupation regime or the complex social and political situation of the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza Strip after two decades of Israeli control. Indeed, most of these leaders had not been inside Palestine since 1967 or earlier. Their understanding of Israeli society and politics was far more limited than the Palestinians who had lived under and watched Israeli rule, many of whom had learned Hebrew in their jobs inside Israel or while serving time in prison. A fifth of the Palestinian population under occupation had passed through these prisons. The consequence was increasingly intrusive management of the Intifada by remote control from Tunis, as the PLO came to dominate what had been a popular resistance movement. It issued directives and ran things from a distance, often ignoring the views and preferences of those who had initiated the revolt and had led it successfully. This problem became considerably more acute after Israel's assassination of Abu Jihad in April 1988, some 4 months after the Intifada began. Abu Jihad, Arafat's closest lieutenant, had been a leading figure in Fatah since the beginning and had long been in charge of dealing with the occupied territories, or, as his department was called, Al-Qita' al-Gharbi, the Western sector, presumably to conceal its true purpose. Abu Jihad had his failings, but he was a close observer of the situation inside Palestine and was deeply knowledgeable about both Palestinians and Israelis there. His assassination, which was a result of the Israeli leadership's mounting frustration at their inability to master the Intifada, deprived the PLO of one of its key figures, whose role could not easily be filled by another. Abu Jihad's killing was part of Israel's decades-long policy of systematic liquidation of top Palestinian organizers, particularly the effective ones among them. The loss of Abu Jihad and the lack of expertise in Tunis was not the only reason for the PLO's problem in dealing with the Intifada. Following the 1982 war, Fatah had weathered a major Syrian-sponsored mutiny among its remaining cadres in northern and eastern Lebanon, from which they had not been evacuated in 1982, and in Syria, led by two senior military commanders, Colonel Abu Musa and Colonel Abu Khalid al-Amla. This was the most serious internal challenge to Fatah's leadership since its founding, and it constituted another element in the largely covert offensive against the Palestinian national movement carried out by Arab regimes, in this case, Syria. The Fatah mutiny was bitter and costly, and intensified the concern of Arafat and his colleagues about the emergence of rivals, especially those under the influence of hostile regimes. The concern was well-founded, given the efforts by the movement's adversaries to create alternatives, such as the village leagues in the occupied territories. Notably, Hamas, founded in 1987, and initially discreetly supported by Israel with the objective of weakening the PLO, was already beginning to develop into a formidable competitor. This alarm at the possibility of being superseded was at the root of the PLO leadership's jealousy of the Intifada's local leaders, especially as their following grew within Palestine and the global media came to view them positively. Arafat's resentment became an increasing problem as the Intifada progressed and as the PLO's long-desired prize, a place at international negotiations as the legitimate representative of the Palestinian people, appeared to come within its reach. Just as they had a weak understanding of the reality inside the occupied territories and Israel, the PLO's leaders had never grasped the full measure of the United States. Even after 1982, they remained ill-informed about the country and its politics, with the exception of a few second-rank figures, such as Nabil Sha'ath and Elias Shufani, who had been educated in the United States but were unable to influence Arafat and his partners. Some senior PLO leaders, such as Farouk al-Qadoumi, Abu Lutuf, head of the political department, effectively foreign minister, attended sessions of the UN General Assembly in New York every fall, but they were legally restricted to a travel radius of 25 miles from Columbus Circle. In any case, they mostly stayed put in their luxury hotels for the duration of their visits. They ventured out infrequently to see Arab diplomats or to speak to Palestinian community groups, but made few public appearances and did not engage with American groups or the New York media. They certainly never undertook the all-points diplomatic and public relations campaigns of Israeli officials, who were ubiquitous on TV and at regional gatherings at all times, and especially when the annual meetings of the General Assembly came around. The failure to take advantage of the Palestinian presence at the UN amounted to willfully ignoring the people, the elites, and the media of the greatest power on earth and the mainstay of Israel, an approach that dated back to 1948 and before. As I saw in 1984, Arafat gave more importance to meeting the leader of a minor PLO faction linked to Iraq than to listening to expert advice about swaying public opinion in the United States. The situation had not improved since then. A simplistic view of the structures of government and decision-making in Washington led the PLO to pin all its hopes on winning the U.S. government's recognition as the legitimate Palestinian interlocutor. American good offices for a fair deal with the Israelis would surely follow. This attitude carried a trace of the naive faith of earlier generations of Palestinian leaders, shared by many Arab rulers to this day, that a personal appeal to a British colonial secretary or prime minister, a U.S. secretary of state or president, could solve the problem. This illusory view of the personal element in power relations may have been grounded in the experience of dealing with mercurial, all-powerful dictators and absolute monarchs in the Arab world. It was also partly shaped by the experience of the Arab monarchs who saw U.S. Secretary of State George Shultz, who had headed Bechtel, a major contractor in the Gulf, and later President George H.W. Bush and his Secretary of State James Baker, Texans with past links to the oil industry, as pro-Arab. Indeed, as with most other U.S. policymakers since Roosevelt, these men were closely tied to the Arab petro-monarchies, but this did not translate into sympathy for the Arabs generally, or for the Palestinians in particular, or into a critical attitude toward Israel. These flawed understandings were at the root of the PLO's failure to engage seriously with U.S. public opinion and become involved in peace negotiations through the late 1980s. However, in 1988, buoyed by the international impact of the Intifada, the organization redoubled its efforts, culminating in the Palestinian Declaration of Independence adopted at a meeting of the Palestine National Council in Algiers on November 15th. Drafted largely by Mahmoud Darwish, who was aided by Edward Said and the respected intellectual Shafiq al-Hut, the document formally abandoned the PLO's claim to the entirety of Palestine, accepting the principles of partition, a two-state solution, and a peaceful resolution to the conflict. An accompanying political communique accepted SC-242 and SC-338 as the basis for a peace conference. These were major political shifts for the PLO, the culmination of an evolution toward acceptance of Israel and advocacy of a Palestinian state alongside it that had begun in the early 1970s. Although these changes were unacknowledged by its Israeli adversaries, a more significant shift was yet to come. On December 14th that year, Arafat accepted U.S. conditions for entering a bilateral dialogue. In his statement, he explicitly accepted Resolutions 242 and 338, recognized the right of Israel to exist in peace and security, and renounced terrorism. This capitulation to American conditions finally obtained for the PLO the long-sought opening with Washington, but it neither moved the Israelis to agree to deal with the organization nor led to peace negotiations, at least not for three more years. The reasons for this were simple. Beyond the PLO's other misassumptions about the United States, its leaders failed to grasp the lack of American concern, even its disdain, for their interests and aims. This incomprehension is hard to fathom in light of the painful betrayal of American promises to safeguard the refugee camps in Beirut in 1982. Most important, though, was their inability to understand how intimately the policies of the United States and Israel were linked. Kissinger's secret 1975 commitments locked U.S. policymakers' feet in cement where dealing with the Palestine question was concerned. The PLO might not have known that Israel had effectively secured veto power over U.S. positions in any peace talks, but there had been enough credible leaks in the press and elsewhere about these secret agreements, mainly from Israelis, who were understandably eager to publicize them. There had also been embarrassing incidents, as when Andrew Young, ambassador to the UN, was forced to resign after meeting with a PLO official. The general terms of U.S. commitments to Israel should have been clear to an informed observer. This Arafat and his colleagues definitely were not. The Intifada had delivered to them a gift of inestimable value, a store of moral and political capital. The popular revolt had revealed the limits of the military occupation, damaged Israel's international standing, and improved that of the Palestinians. For all the effectiveness of the PLO in its first decades in putting Palestine back on the global map, it can be argued that the Intifada had a more positive impact on world opinion than the organization's generally ineffective efforts at armed struggle ever had. The director of the Mossad at the time, Nahum Admonai, confirmed this, saying, "The Intifada caused us a lot more political harm, damage to our image, than everything that the PLO had succeeded in doing throughout its existence." Trading on this significant new asset enabled the PLO leadership to abandon formally its strategy of armed struggle from bases outside Palestine, which in any case was increasingly impossible after 1982, and in their hands had never had much chance of success if it was not actually harmful to the Palestinian cause. Even before 1982, many in the PLO understood that the time had come to end the armed struggle. While still based in Lebanon, its leaders had tasked the distinguished Pakistani intellectual Iqbal Ahmad, a close friend of Edward Said and a friend of mine, with assessing their military strategy. Ahmad had worked with the Front de Libération Nationale in Algeria in the early 1960s, had known Frantz Fanon, and was a renowned Third World anti-colonial thinker. After visiting PLO bases in South Lebanon, he returned with a critique that disconcerted those who had asked his advice. While in principle a committed supporter of armed struggle against colonial regimes, such as that in Algeria, Ahmad had strong criticisms of the ineffective and often counterproductive way in which the PLO was carrying out this strategy. More seriously, on political rather than moral or legal grounds, he questioned whether armed struggle was the right course of action against the PLO's particular adversary, Israel. He argued that given the course of Jewish history, especially in the 20th century, the use of force only strengthened a pre-existing and pervasive sense of victimhood among Israelis, while it unified Israeli society, reinforced the most militant tendencies in Zionism, and bolstered the support of external actors. This was in distinction to Algeria, where the FLN's use of violence, including women using baskets to carry bombs, which have taken so many innocent lives, in the accusatory words of a French interrogator in the 1966 Gillo Pontecorvo film, The Battle of Algiers, ultimately succeeded in dividing French society and eroding its support for the colonial project. Ahmad's critique was profound and devastating, and not welcomed by the PLO's leaders, who still publicly proclaimed a devotion to armed struggle even as they were moving away from it in practice. Beyond his acute understanding of the deep connection between Zionism and the long history of persecution of Jews in Europe, Ahmad's analysis shrewdly perceived the unique nature of the Israeli colonial project. The mainly non-violent intifada in Palestine enabled Arafat to take account, albeit belatedly, of Ahmad's view, and at the same time to respond positively to a prime U.S. condition for dialogue, renouncing armed resistance, deemed to be terrorism by the United States and Israel. However, the results of the PLO's naivete regarding the United States soon became apparent. In and of themselves, recognition by the United States and a seat at the negotiating table were unexceptionable aims. Every anti-colonial movement, whether in Algeria, Vietnam, or South Africa, desired its foes to accept its legitimacy and to negotiate with it for an honorable end to the conflict. In all these cases, however, an honorable outcome meant ending occupation and colonization, and ideally reaching a peaceful reconciliation based on justice. That was the primary object of the negotiations sought by other liberation movements. But instead of using the Intifada's success to hold out for a forum framed in terms of such liberatory needs, the PLO allowed itself to be drawn into a process explicitly designed by Israel, with the acquiescence of the United States, to prolong its occupation and colonization, not to end them. The PLO desperately pursued admission to supposed peace negotiations, whose narrow parameters were from the outset restricted by SC 242 in ways that were enormously disadvantageous to the Palestinians. SC 242 includes no mention of the Palestine question, or of the Arab state specified in UNGA Resolution 181 in 1947, or of the return of refugees mandated by UNGA Resolution 194 of 1948. With its carefully drafted wording about withdrawal from territories occupied in 1967 rather than the territories occupied, 242 effectively gave Israel a chance to expand its pre-1967 borders further. Whether they realized it or not, by accepting Resolution 242 as the basis for any negotiations, Arafat and his colleagues had set themselves an impossible task. They also failed to understand the need to continue to put pressure on one's adversaries. With the end of armed struggle and the waning of the Intifada in the early 1990s, this became less and less possible. Once talks finally began, in Madrid in the fall of 1991, the PLO tried to put a halt to the Intifada. It did not stop, but petered out a few years later, as if launching negotiations were the end of the process rather than the beginning. Added to the fact that the United States could never be an honest broker given the commitments it had undertaken, Israel also had its own independent positions. Thus, any concessions made by the PLO to the United States did not necessarily bind Israel or make it more willing to deal with the organization. In fact, when at the end of the Reagan administration the United States finally began a dialogue with the PLO following its 1988 declaration, Israel became even more intransigent. Furthermore, the PLO did not seem to comprehend the full import of the 1978 Camp David deal and subsequent 1979 Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty, in which Menachem Begin had struck a ruinous bargain over Palestine with Anwar Sadat and Jimmy Carter. Also, the decline of the USSR meant that the PLO lost an intermittent and inconsistent patron that had provided military and diplomatic support and had championed its inclusion in negotiations under far less onerous terms than those demanded by the United States and Israel. By the end of 1991, however, the USSR had disappeared, and the United States was left as the sole international guarantor and sponsor of any Palestinian-Israeli process. Another grave blow to the PLO's standing was the profound miscalculation made by Yasser Arafat and most of his colleagues regarding the 1990-91 Gulf War, almost immediately after Iraq's invasion and occupation of Kuwait in August 1990. The Gulf states, together with virtually every other major Arab power, including Egypt and Syria, joined the U.S.-led international coalition to forcibly reverse Saddam Hussein's gross violation of the sovereignty of a member state of the Arab League. This was in keeping with the consistent preference of post-colonial states in Asia, Africa, and the Middle East for the preservation of colonial borders and the states that had grown up within them. Instead of firmly supporting Kuwait against Iraq, Arafat tried to steer a neutral course, offering to mediate between the two sides. His suggestion was ignored by all concerned, as were the mediating efforts of more powerful actors, such as the USSR, which fruitlessly sent its senior Middle East envoy to Baghdad. There were multiple reasons for the PLO's bizarre decision to essentially support Iraq, a move that made the organization a pariah among the Gulf states, on which it depended for financial support, and harmed it in innumerable other ways. First among these reasons was Arafat's long-standing and fierce antipathy toward Hafez al-Assad's overbearing Syrian regime, an antipathy that was richly reciprocated, and his reflexive search for a counterweight. One of Arafat's signature slogans, Al-Qarar al-Filistini al-Mustaqil, the independent Palestinian decision, was usually brandished in response to Syrian efforts to coerce, constrain, and dominate the PLO. While Egypt had once served to balance the pressures exerted by the Assad regime, that role was no longer possible after Sadat's separate peace with Israel. The only other plausible counterweight had of necessity been Syria's rival, Iraq. In the wake of Sadat's apostasy, the PLO had become increasingly dependent on Iraqi political, military, and financial patronage, especially after the Syrian regime sought to undermine Arafat's leadership by masterminding the fratricidal rebellion against him in 1982. This dependency subjected Arafat and the PLO to intense pressure to conform to Iraqi policies, which were dictated by the vagaries of Saddam Hussein, a thuggish despot who was ignorant, mercurial, and brutal. To keep the PLO in line, the Iraqi regime frequently punished it. Among the many tools for this purpose, Baghdad had at its disposal various nominally Palestinian splinter groups like Abu Nidal's terrorist network, the Ba'athist Arab Liberation Front, and the Palestine Liberation Front, headed by Abu al-Abbas. All these tiny groups lacked a popular base and were essentially extensions of the fearsome Iraqi intelligence service, although, as we have seen, Abu Nidal's guns for hire were also at times clandestinely employed by the Libyan and Syrian regimes and were deeply penetrated by other intelligence services. Any one of them could carry out operations designed to undermine the PLO or attack its leaders to force it back into line with the Iraqi regime. Indeed, for a time, Abu Nidal's gunmen murdered almost as many PLO envoys and leaders in Europe as did the Mossad. These fronts for several Arab regimes also specialized in spectacular terror operations against Israeli and Jewish civilians, such as the Abu Nidal's group, 1985 Rome and Vienna airport massacres, and its bloody 1986 assault on an Istanbul synagogue, or the PLF's 1985 attack on the Achille Lauro cruise liner. Their dependency on Iraq apart, Arafat and others wildly overestimated Iraqi military capacities in 1990-91. They had an inflated judgment of Iraq's ability to withstand the onslaught by the U.S.-led coalition that was clearly coming after the invasion of Kuwait. This delusional view, Iraq had been unable to defeat Iran in 8 years of war, was widespread in various parts of the Arab world. In the months before the inevitable U.S.-led counteroffensive began, otherwise intelligent, well-informed people in Palestine, Lebanon, and Jordan loudly pronounced their certainty that war would not come. but if it did, Iraq would prevail. Arafat was in some measure carried along by a popular tide, as large segments of Arab public opinion shared this fantasy. Many supported Saddam Hussein's land grab as a nationalist blow against colonially imposed frontiers, as if most of the frontiers and states in the Arab East had not also been colonially imposed. Saddam was seen by those thus deluded as a great Arab hero, a new Saladin. The original Saladin had come from Tikrit, Hussein's birthplace, who could surely defeat the United States and its allies. The one exception to the PLO's consensus of idiocy was its intelligence chief, Abu Iyad, among the brightest and most grounded of its senior leaders. He understood that the chosen course would lead to disaster and fought fiercely against the decision to back Iraq, provoking tempestuous arguments with Arafat. As well as the obvious reasons for his stance, he was concerned with safeguarding the prosperous Palestinian community in Kuwait, which was several hundred thousand strong. Both he and Arafat had lived and worked in Kuwait for years, and he had close ties to the community, which furnished one of the PLO's most solid popular and financial bases anywhere in the world. Moreover, Kuwait itself was supportive toward the PLO and was the only Arab country where Palestinians had relative freedom of expression. They ran their own schools and could organize to help the PLO as long as they took care not to interfere in Kuwaiti politics. Abu Iyad argued that Arafat's failure to oppose Saddam's suicidal invasion of Kuwait would weaken the PLO and condemn Palestinians there to the destruction of their community and another forced displacement. It all played out exactly as Abu Iyad had foreseen, but he paid for his temerity. He had reportedly even criticized Saddam Hussein in person. He was assassinated in Tunis on January 14, 1991. 3 days before the U.S.-led offensive began. The gunman was acting for the Abu Nidal network, and by extension undoubtedly for Iraq, which the PLO intelligence services under Abu Iyad had hunted for years. The loss of Abu Iyad, coming 3 years after the killing of Abu Jihad, left no one in the top Fatah echelons with the stature or will to stand up to Arafat, a situation that only enhanced his inclination to high-handedness. The consequences of Arafat's ill-considered decision were not long in coming. Beginning with the tragic uprooting of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from Kuwait after the country's liberation, the Gulf states halted all financial support to the PLO, which was ostracized in many Arab countries, including some of those that had agreed to host its cadres after the 1982 evacuation from Beirut. Thus, after the 1990-91 Gulf War, the PLO found itself more friendless and alone than perhaps at any stage in its history. The icebergs on which Arafat and his comrades were afloat were melting fast, and they were desperately eager to jump to solid ground. It happened that this crisis coincided with a moment of American triumphalism, with the victory in Iraq and the end of the Soviet Union. In George H.W. Bush's State of the Union speech in January 1991, he hailed the New World Order and the Next American Century. The Bush administration was determined to take advantage of the opportunity that Saddam's folly had given them to shape and define this new world order, one that in their view necessitated a resolution of the Arab-Israeli conflict. Israeli and American diplomats knew that the PLO's negotiating position was severely weakened. It was in this context that Secretary of State James Baker began planning for a peace conference to be held in Madrid in October 1991, hoping to jumpstart direct Israeli-Arab talks and determine the future of Palestine. When Arafat and his colleagues were eventually offered a proxy seat at the negotiating table, they were under so much pressure and so eager to leave their precarious perches in Tunis and elsewhere that they failed to assess their vast disadvantage. The setbacks that followed in the negotiations at Madrid, Washington, Oslo, and thereafter, were thus to a large extent rooted in the PLO's epic miscalculation over Kuwait.